Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archive programs are available on our website, WGTD.org, and you're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page.
Support comes from Kenosha Harbor Market, back outside in the nice weather. Enjoy cheese and dairy products from Decatur Dairy, offering over a dozen varieties of cheese, as well as squeaky cheese curds and glass all naturals. Cheese-based flavor spreads with no preservatives. The outdoor market is open Saturday from 9 till 2.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea. It's patio season, which means alfresco dining at Jack's Cafe. Stop by and enjoy the sun along with breezy summer cafe soda fountain specials. Proudly serving the Kenosha community since 1911. 2401 60th Street, Kenosha. Support for WGTD comes from Classic Violins, the premier southeastern Wisconsin workshop for family violin instruments. Master Luthier, always on premises. Free estimates. ClassicViolins.com, 262-577-5488.
Support comes from Carthage College, welcoming John Meacham, author of the new book, Soul of America. He'll be on campus to share historical insight into today's political climate, Saturday, May 26th at 2 p.m. Learn more at carthage.edu/soul. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that highlights various local issues and organizations. It's co-hosted by Len Iaquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, WGTD Walworth County correspondent Jim McClure, and by Linda Fleshinsky, a mother, grandmother, freelance writer, and former Racine School Board president. And now, here's today's host.
WGTD and this, our Saturday morning program, Community Matters. I'm Linda Fleshinsky, the host for this week's edition of Community Matters. I'm excited about today's program because it's a topic of great interest to me. Today we will talk about the process of writing, how good writing comes to be. And so it is a special joy for me to have with us today in my studio Kim Sir, who is the director. She's a published author and the director of Red Oak Writing Studio in Milwaukee. And Pam Parker, also a published author who takes sessions at Red Oaks and who has published a novel, among other writings. Oh, not published yet. She has written a novel. Thank you. We will discuss how people develop an interest in writing, what the process of writing entails, what resources are out there for beginning writers, how the process of being published occurs, and what people can do if they are serious about becoming writers. So I welcome you today, Kim and Pam, and I thank you so much for driving down from Milwaukee and for joining us today.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you. Kim. Let's start with you. Did you always feel like you wanted to be a writer, or is that something that evolved with you over time?
You know, if I'm honest, I probably always wanted to be a writer. I loved reading as a kid, and I thought whatever those writers did to make me love that was pretty magical. But I didn't know what that would look like. I wouldn't have trusted that I had the skills to do it, mm-hmm. and I had no idea what being a writer looked like. So I did the next best thing, which is to teach writing mm-hmm. and literature, and I taught high school English for years and did my own writing on the side, but I was finding that my writing was kind of plateauing, kind of to the level of a really good high school writer because I kind of rose to the level of
probably
the people
better,
I was teaching. And so as part of my master's degree, I was able to weave in some graduate writing classes, and a couple of professors in that program kind of took me aside and said, you know, this piece would be good to be published. Mm-hmm. Have you ever thought about publishing? And that was something, another thing that I didn't imagine and know anything about. So I took their advice and submitted both, and one of them was published and one of them wasn't. But I think that was the first time that I kind of maybe believed that this was something that I could do in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Not full-time, but and I took a writing class with Judy Bridges at Redbird Studio, Shut Up and Write, and my friend Pam here was in that class like 16 years ago or something. And just took classes over the years and did some more teaching. And I was eventually teaching roundtable critique groups. And I felt like my writing kind of plateaued a little bit. And so mm-hmm. I took a master's in fine arts degree, and
great.
That really pushed my writing to a new mm-hmm. level, and it also made me a better critiquer of other people's writing. So mm-hmm. I have a collection of short stories, some of which that have been published and some not, and I'm hoping to find a publisher mm-hmm. for the collection soon. So.
I think sometimes the taking of classes is really where you first start feeling like you're a writer. Mm-hmm. I always wrote too, but then I took a poetry writing class, and I thought, what am I doing? You know, the kids were little, and I was taken off, you know, a couple days a week to take this with Carl Lindner, actually, at UW Parkside. But I thought, you know, I always think when I hear people's writing that, oh, gosh, they write so well, I can't do that. But I did, you know, I really produced some things in there that I thought were good. Mm-hmm. I'm going to switch to you now, Pam, and just ask you the same question. Did you always feel like you wanted to be a writer, or was that an evolving thing with you?
For me, it was definitely an evolving thing. I always loved to write, and I, like Kim, loved to read. But I didn't have the spine, I guess, to even imagine being a writer all the time. I just felt intimidated by some of my favorite authors instead of inspired by them. Mm-hmm. So my first job out of college was in public relations, and I did a lot of writing there and really loved it. And then I taught for a while, middle school social studies, and it was when I took the Shut Up and Write class with Kim that I started to realize, oh, mm-hmm. you know, this has been missing for me, and I want to do more writing. Mm-hmm. And that's when I really started doing more writing. And even from then on, there was very definitely a long learning curve and evolving, and I'm always learning. Mm-hmm. And am starting to apply for MFA programs now myself.
Great.
So.
Great. And for our listeners, for both of you, what kind of writing do you primarily do?
I do really both fiction and creative nonfiction. So I have published both short stories and essays.
Mm-hmm. And I've read the essays, and, you know, both of you, your writing is really incredible, really, really good. Kim, I want to go back to Red Oak for a minute and just ask you, what kind of programs Red Oak offers, because I know we have listeners out there. So many people really want to write or are writing all along, and they don't know it until they take a class or something and somebody says you have a talent at that. You know, I think you know if you can sing or not. I can't sing. You know if you can draw pictures. I can't draw pictures. but writing, everybody can write, you think, but it really is an art that needs honing. Is that right, Kim?
Yeah, definitely. We are kind of our major offering is our roundtable critique groups, and that is a place where people kind of learn what they have. I think sometimes they begin, they read their work aloud and get feedback from the other writers, and sometimes they want to begin, this isn't really very good, and then they read it, and then they listen to what people say about it, and people could find all kinds of good things in there. It may not be polished, it may not be publishing ready, but there's good stuff in there, mm-hmm. and so that's kind of it's what I really enjoy about the job and what people get at the table. We do craft and publishing classes once a month for people who want to hone their craft and want to learn about the publishing world. We offer author readings where it's really once a quarter, pretty much. They're at Comedy Sports in Milwaukee, and we select a few of our writers to share their work with an audience, and that kind of expands. It's kind of twofold. It expands their audience, and it also gives them confidence at the podium with their work. We do manuscript critiques and one-on-one coaching for people who either in person or online. That's been working well. We have an online roundtable critique group, and we also have creative writing camps in the summer for kids, which started with Redbird Studio and Judy Bridges so many years ago, and it was a group of writers kind of saying, what would we have wanted when we were 15 years old mm-hmm. and lonely writers with no tribe? And it's a pretty special thing in the summer, too. So,
I taught a little creative writing with kids. I did poetry writing with College for Kids in the summer, and then I went around and did some residencies at schools. But it is amazing, isn't it, what comes out of kids? Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
And when I started, I'd use structured things, and I think that was my insecurity. And the longer I went working with kids, the more I said, you know, first of all, try to do it without rhyme, probably. Try to just describe. And I'd give them a whole bunch of, I got looser and looser, you know, really just write what you want to write about today. But I'd give them beginnings so mm-hmm. that But there's amazing things come out of those kids.
And the great thing, I used to teach in the summer camps at Red Oak, too. And the really fun thing as an instructor was that, I mean, when kids started in those camps, they didn't leave. Mm-hmm. So watching them and their writing change and evolve was just so fun.
Yeah, I had kids who their moms put them in because they thought they should be writing more, you know, and the kids really reluctantly came, but we made College for Kids really fun. Like, we'd have a paper day, and they'd make the paper, and then we'd go write, and or we had a clown day. We had an outside bubbles day, but it was always back to the writing. You know, it was a whole half day, so we had a lot of time to do fun things, but what they ended up liking was the writing. Mm-hmm. It was their favorite class if they took two classes. Mm-hmm. So they really need, kids really want to express this.
Right. And we called it, I assume you still do, sacred writing time. And as the kids would get older, by the time they were in high school, they would want more and more sacred writing time.
Mm-hmm. That and to share.
Yes.
You know, on the first day of camp, the kids were like, I'm so nervous. I don't want to share my writing. What, you know? And by day two, they're like, is it time to share yet? I have something that I want to share. And so that's just a sweet part of it as well.
It is so sweet. Yeah. It is so sweet. The hands just go up to read. And not on the first day. Not on the first day. But, boy, every day, more and more. I actually found that with adults, too, is that I did a class at Gateway. Written communication. So it was very, you had to go through, of course, all the things. But I threw a creative writing in every day, a short warm-up. And at the end, I had them do one really creative writing for the end of the class. But I had a woman come up to me, and she said, my son hated his classes in grade school. He hated his classes in high school. And he said, but he can't say enough. And I know it wasn't me. It was the experience of writing and sharing with other adults, you know, and young adults.
I think some of it was you, too.
I think so, too.
You can take a little credit.
For both of you, what is your writing process like? Like, authors talk about this a lot. Do you, no matter what, first thing in the morning, I took some class from a famous writer, and I'm trying to remember her name. It was a long time ago. But literally, she'd unplug the phone at 9. And do you have a time specific that you write? And do you have a place kind of specific? And do you use a computer?
She picked the wrong people to ask this question. We were talking about this on the way here. And that is that I won't speak for Pam, but kind of a binge writer.
Okay.
When I'm working on a project, I find ways to carve out time in my schedule. And when I'm not, I don't have that discipline of sitting down and waiting for it to happen. Though you do have to sit down and invite the muse, as they say. So it's kind of a combination of both. But I'm a fits and starts.
Uh-huh.
I wish I were a disciplined every day, but I'm not.
I bet most people who write are, because you have a life out there. I mean, you don't only write, although sometimes it seems like that. What about for you, Pam?
I'm very much a binge writer also. And at times I fight that. I will try and force myself to go and write. And I would say at times I'm better at that than others.
Mm-hmm.
As far as a place, I do have a writing studio now that I rent. And I think I'm not quite in the rhythm there that I had hoped to be by this point. And that has to do with just a lot of other, you know, family things and personal things. But my goal is to be writing there every morning. And I'm never a person who will go to write for 4 or 5 hours. I have tried that. That does not work for me. I'm a two-hour chunk person. If I'm revising a longer piece, then I can spend more time. But I'm still likely to, you know, an hour and a half to 2 hours. I can usually get an awful lot done in that amount of time. But for me, it has proven to be best when I do that in the morning.
Yes. For me, that would be the best time, but a lot of times morning doesn't work out. The thing that helps me is I'm still mostly an essay columnist writer, but as I have deadlines, although the newspaper's sort of loose about it, they say you can turn it, but I'm going for the first Sunday of every month for publication, so that means the third week. I have to get it in of a month. And deadlines help me. I thought, you know, once I could have gotten a job for a newspaper, and looking back, I don't know, I had a lot of nice jobs. So, but if I had done that, maybe I would have realized sooner that I like writing, you know. Right. But the deadlines help me. I have to sit down once a month and say, okay, this is it.
The one thing I do try to write just about every day are morning pages, which, you know, some of your listeners might not be familiar with that concept. Julia Cameron has a book called The Artist's Way.
The Artist's Way.
And she really encourages this idea of morning pages. The idea being you sit down first thing, if at all possible, and quickly write, you know, a few pages. And I think of it as just sort of my morning brain dump. This is not, you know, trying to explore writing concepts for me. Other people use it differently. For me, it's just a very important kind of grounding, touching base with myself, maybe trying to shed some worries and things before I get on with my day.
What did you call it again?
Morning pages.
Morning pages. Is that your made-up term?
No. Julia Cameron.
Julia Cameron. What a great thing, morning pages. I really want to start doing that every day. And I kind of do try, but I end up writing the most when my deadline is there. So.
You know, to chime in about place, too, you know, Pam has a studio, and not everybody can do that. But I do think there's value in having the place that in your mind is your writing place. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's a chair in the corner of my office where that's what I do there. Yeah. I've also heard the advice, and I think it's really good advice, that you should not revise where you write, that you see your piece differently. So, you know, just and you know, for people who are thinking, is this something I'd like to do but I can't do because I don't have a studio. You know, it can be that chair in the basement or whatever it is. That just kind of cues your brain, this is what I'm doing here now.
And even, you know, the same coffee shop.
I did
a lot of writing of my novel, you know, in one particular coffee shop. Yeah. Not all of it, but and that helped.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we writers can come up with excuses easily, I think, and easily we can react to distractions. So it is where I like to write, and you guys have to tell me if this is a problem for you, but I like sitting in my reclining chair. I tend to wake up before my husband, and sometimes pretty early, sometimes 4 or 5. And I take my notebook, and I turn on the gas fireplace if it's not hot summer, and I recline the chair, and I write in this notebook. And the problem with that is I have to retype it then. So when you sit in your reclining chair, do you do it with a laptop? Do you write with a laptop?
I believe in the handwritten first draft, actually.
Okay, you're nodding. Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that's comforting to me because I think anybody else would take a laptop and then you don't have to go to the computer and retype it. Plus, I write in shorthand sometimes and then I'm going, what did I mean?
The problem with the laptop for me is the delete button is so close. And I just keep doing the chug back and forth until I get the absolute perfect word, and it just takes me forever to get any forward progress. And something about handwriting, there's all kinds of brain studies too about, you know, that your brain works differently, but I just can't get anywhere for my first drafts, at least for creative stuff.
Me too.
And you're nodding too, Pam.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm even in the revising process, if I hit something, you know, assuming I've already made the jump to the laptop, but if I hit something where I'm having too many questions and I need to think more about this part, I will switch over to handwriting to you know, kind of work this part out and then go back in and type it in.
Mm-hmm. You know what's interesting is it seems like, I always think, is this a generational thing and that we grew up handwriting?
Me too.
However, kids at camp can have laptops, and I would say out of a group of 15 or 20 kids, there may be two or three writing on laptops. The rest of them are writing in that notebook.
That's interesting.
Isn't
because
it?
I was going to ask you guys, is it our age that we started out writing in the notebook and... But that's a very interesting.
Well,
interesting,
and there were years where with the middle schoolers, you know, we would kind of mandate the notebook for a while. So maybe we helped train them too by the time they got to high school to see what we were talking about and experiencing it. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, and some of them are excluded. One year we had a kid type an entire, well, his novel for the week, or her, I can't remember, on their phone.
Oh, wow.
With thumbs.
With
but,
that tiny. Yeah, well, they
but
do
that's
their
unusual.
Thumbs so fast.
That's very unusual.
I want you guys to read some each of you a piece of your work, but I want to first, because you kind of just alluded to it, speak a little to the revision process. There's a writer, maybe a poet, I can't remember who it was, who says, I never finish a poem, I finally just stop. And I've found, as I've gotten to be, I'm not a great writer, but a little better writer than I've been, is every single time I read a piece, a column for the newspaper that I'm writing, an essay, I never read it that I don't change something. So I identified with that poet, I think it was, who said, I finally just stop. Mm-hmm. So how's the revision process for you guys? And do you change everything, or do you write something sometimes that it's just good the way it is and you don't touch it?
Well, for me, I'd almost say it's different with every piece. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not trying to wiffle-waffle, but I think that is true.
Mm-hmm.
And as to whether it's done or not, which was almost sounding like where you were going, I once heard Robert Boswell, an author, say at a conference when he was asked, how do you know when it's really done? And he replied, when the casket lid closes. And at the time, I didn't really understand.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had a few pieces published. And when you go back and read something of yours that has been published, you'll find this one sentence and go, oh, why didn't I, blah, blah, blah. So then I understood what he meant.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so knowing when it's done is a challenge, I think, for many writers, because you could keep reworking something forever.
And you think of more things, like if you're doing a column, you think, oh, this, you know, writer said this or this, whatever, and then you go add it on, and you know, I tend to have too long columns, but they've been printing them, so. What about you, Kim, with revision?
I love the revision process. Actually, I love it way more than the generation process. But I think, like, to know when something's done, some people say it's never done, it just gets abandoned, that kind of the same vein. But I think when I start changing things back to the way they were originally, like, you put this paragraph in, then you take it out, you put it back in, and pretty soon it's like, okay, it's just time to pick one and be done. So.
Right. And just in the roundtable process, because it's wonderful, I find it wonderful, because like last week I thought, can I really do this column, that love and marriage one? And actually, you guys all liked it. And then I also did a humor one, and I wanted to know from the class, humor's hard for me to do. Does it really come off as humor? And you guys helped me a lot with that. But do you, like, in the roundtable process, in something I just read, they took out the whole first paragraph. These are just suggestions, you know, the writer always makes the final decision, and took out a quote that I kind of liked that led into this piece, and then it tied it back up at the end, and they took both of them out. So I'm like fighting with myself about this. Were they right? Am I right? But what do you find in the roundtable? Is it helpful to you? And
I've found it very helpful to me, and I think I would urge one caution on you, which is they didn't take anything out.
Right. I phrased that wrong. That's why I said it's really up to the writer at the end.
Right.
Yes.
So, but you do, in a roundtable group, you are sharing your work, and then the group of other writers are offering their thoughts on what you have done. And you grow in that process too, I think.
Yes.
As a writer. So, you know, when I first went to roundtables, I think I was a little more bothered by those major suggestions like you're talking about. And I internalized all of that, but I felt like maybe my writing was being attacked. And it didn't take long, though, for me to realize that, no, these were suggestions.
Right.
These were helpful. And ultimately, it would be completely my decision what of that advice I would take and what I wouldn't.
Right. And I've never felt attacked exactly, but what I do, because for one thing, the people who are critiquing you are good writers. So if they think that first paragraph and last one should go, I weigh it heavily in my mind. I don't just say, no, I'm not going to do that. But I might at the end not do it, you know. Hmm. Kim, what do you find as the instructor or the leader?
Well, just thinking about it, in some of the very best roundtables, you get actually diametrically opposed feedback.
Yes, yes.
Where someone will sing the praises of this, and at a really good roundtable, someone else will say, yeah, but. And so then at least as the writer, you get to hear the two different versions
yes.
in someone else's voice. And I think sometimes that gives you the objectivity that you need to make your decision
right.
about whether whatever stays or goes. And that's I think, some of the greatest energy when that
absolutely.
Happens. So
it is. Like we had somebody say I had too many I's in it. And essays, I mean, columns tend to be I first right. person now. And somebody else said, no, I don't think there were. So you do get diametrically mm-hmm. opposed. Well, I would like our listeners to hear a piece by each of you. So I don't know who wants to start, but they'll just be sharing a short piece of their writing. And I think Pam is going to start with this collection of essays, and she's going to read one she wrote. But it's called Done Darkness. And, you know, having been me being someone who's lived with depression, or not so much me, but the family, and I've had it, I think. But this was a very touching book for me. Very. So this is Pam Parker.
And this is called Fighting the Backbeat. For the most part, I can put on a good face, smile and greet the world with sincerity and gratitude. I live a blessed life. But there's a backbeat playing in my mind. A steady thrum pulsing behind the meetings, the phone calls, the visits. My son said he wants to kill himself. With these words, my attention and focus for my work, my writing, crumble like a stack of blocks kicked over by a 3-year-old. The blocks lie scattered over my living room carpet with to-do items scrawled on each one. Finish 7th revision of novel, update blog, submit applications to residencies, finish and submit short story, update idea log. A blanket seems to cover the blocks, and I tiptoe around, unable to uncover them and consider them, one at a time. You see, my son said he wants to kill himself. Mental illness has visited my family before, and my husband's family. It's become a frequent visitor. We've had suicides, bipolar disorder, clinical depression, and alcoholism. We also have a generous dose of attention deficit issues throughout the family, which can be a blessing for creative types, but obviously has its own challenges. All these issues have scratched their way into our lives. Sure, there are treatments. There is hope. All the family members with the challenges I've listed live lives in a relatively comfortable zone, able to afford a roof over their heads or be helped by family to do so, food in their cupboards, transportation, and for most, a job. My son has been trying for over a year to get a job. Most of his applications have fallen into the black hole of non-response land. He's had 4 interviews in those 14 long months, followed again by nothing. He's 21, going on 17, and at times, thankfully, he is happy. His safe place is the stage. He recently landed the lead role in a local theater production. While he's in a show, he may still be unemployed, but he has a purpose. For me, this quiets the suicide thrum for a while. The backbeat is there, but softer. The volume will increase as his show progresses toward its inevitable close, especially if he hasn't found his next part. Maybe my son won't want to kill himself. Maybe it's not my fault. I don't wallow often in what did I do wrong land, but I do fret. The weight of worries is visible on my stomach, hips, and thighs. I spend my days exploring residential therapeutic programs for him, trying to motivate him to complete another application that is likely to disappear in the ether, talking to my therapist, checking if he's made an appointment with his therapist, and all the while, I try to keep smiling, keep believing, keep showing a happy face, because I have to believe that my son will make it past the desire to kill himself. I did.
That's really good.
Thank you.
I'm choked up. I'm sorry. That's very good. And you read that at what?
It was on Lake Effect on UWM some years ago. Mm-hmm. I should say my son is doing very well now.
That's so great. Both of our guests today have read on Lake Effect, and they both have this profound way of writing, so it's very touching. Kim.
Thank you. So I'm going to read, it's actually a guest blog post at Christy Craig's website, and she's another local writer who's a good friend of Red Oak and also a wonderful writing teacher and writer. And this is to, I hope, give permission to people out there who might need a little nudge to listen to the writer inside. It's called Can't Afford a Writing Class? Maybe. From time to time, people tell me they'd love to improve their writing, but they just can't afford a class. Since I don't have access to their bank accounts and spending habits, I have no way to know if this is true. But I do think that, in some cases, not being able to afford it is akin to not feeling justified in spending money on it. And to those writers, I have one word to say: golf. We all know people who play golf, or ski, or cook, or knit with the verve of a professional, despite the fact that they'll never make a living at their passion. Still, they continue to sink money and time into the activity just for the pleasure of it. Imagine the following arguments against paying for a writing class translated into the golf scenario. 1. I don't need a class. I'll just get better by writing a lot. Practice makes perfect, right? Actually, there's much to like about this reasoning, the whole 10,000 hours to become an expert argument and all. Only thing is, if your golf stroke stinks, increasing the number of swings isn't going to improve your game. In fact, it will probably get progressively worse, or at the very least take a long time to get better. What will help, and in pretty short order, is an expert who can point out your dipped shoulder or the fact that your club face is open. Same with writing. 10,000 hours of point-of-view slips or ill-conceived plots will just make you better at bad writing. Best to get some instruction from someone who knows what they're talking about. Then, the next 9,999 hours will be time well spent. 2. Why not just get a bunch of people together and help each other for free? I like parts of this argument, too. You could get lucky and find some naturally skilled groupmates who give great advice. I've seen it happen for golfers and for writers. On the other hand, you could end up with a duffer who thinks he knows more about golf than he really does. He might advise you to change your grip only to make your slice worse. Let's face it, bad advice is worse than no advice at all. The other hazard here is that your golf game could be so much better than your mates that they can offer no suggestions for improvement. If you've been with the same group of writers for a while without seeing much growth, you probably know what I'm talking about. As a facilitator of critique groups, I can attest to the power of being among writers serious enough about their work to pay for a class and committed enough to meet deadlines and do the hard work of revision. A third reason is often unspoken, but I believe is at the heart of many emerging writers' reluctance to invest money in writing classes. The chances of making the big time are slim. Why would I spend money when I probably won't see tangible financial feedback? Payback, I mean. Sadly, there is much truth to this. No matter how avid a golfer you are, it isn't likely you'll be in the Masters tournament anytime soon. Still, golfers are out there every Saturday morning doing what they love, spending a fair amount of money on it, and not feeling guilty in the least. No one is saying to them, "Why do you play so much golf? You'll never make any money at it anyway." Why then do we apply the same standard to writing? Sure, from any one writing class, it will be difficult to see a direct monetary payoff on investment. But when you splurge on a class, you find your tribe and deeper connections with those who share in your passion. Taken together, what you gain from classes, conferences, and critique groups adds up to stronger writing and better chances of publishing if that's your goal. In the end, for many people, it comes down to this: how do I honor my desire to become a better writer? Do I really mean that I can't afford a class or that I don't feel justified in taking one? If your answer is the latter, I encourage you to reconsider. The call to write is every bit as important as other pursuits, maybe more so. Think of the words that have moved you. Consider the writers who claimed the time and used financial resources to write them for you. Imagine how your words may do the same for your readers one day. Remember, your writing will last much longer than a golf score.
Wow, that is excellent. For the sake of our listeners, I'd really like to say, have you guys say something about the process of publishing, because we know what a frustrating thing that is and how many phenomenal writers, like the woman who wrote, I think it's Montgomery, wrote Anne of Green Gables and Dr. Seuss, and so many people really had to work at getting published. And if they had given up, we wouldn't have Green Eggs and Ham and How the Grinch Stole Christmas and Yertle the Turtle. But it is a frustrating process, and probably more so today because there are fewer publishers. So maybe you could speak a little to the process of submitting, and also maybe some of these independent publishers who now people are paying. I did that with my columns. I went to createspace.com. It costs something, but they get you there. They get you the layout, the cover, the ISBN number, it's kind of done for you. So maybe you'd both like to speak a little to that.
So I think the first question the writer always needs to ask themselves is, who are they writing this for? So we have different, there are so many different ways to go. Like for you with your column, you have something to say that people in your community will appreciate. So that's a logical, way to go. I have published both short fiction and nonfiction, but I have, my novel is really my passion project, I would say. And longer fiction does seem to be the hardest nut to crack in the publishing world. It just is. So, I have done some things to try and get myself to the point where I may get an agent and I may be able to traditionally publish that novel. And the question for me now only is, how long will I keep trying that? So in the last year, I have had 6 agents request the entire manuscript, but all 6 of them declined to take me on as a client. To me, at this moment in time, that says to me, I have a very publishable novel, but I have to find the right agent who will say, yes, I'm taking this on. Then another waiting process begins when that person starts trying to shop it around to other publishers. So at some point, I may say, nope, I'm done. I'm going to have to do this myself. And I would find a smaller independent press. Some you have to pay, some you don't. And, try and do it that way. And we'll just have to see. On my anthology, Dun Darkness, anthologies don't traditionally sell well. And so agents and publishers aren't all that interested unless you've got some really established big name writers. But Kathy Lanzarotti, who co-edited this with me, we both have a real strong interest in trying to open communications about mental health issues. So we decided we were going to do this project together, and we approached Orange Hat Publishing, which is a small publisher in Waukesha, to work with. And they're what you would call a hybrid press. So you do have to put in some of your own money, but they won't publish just anything.
Kim.
Yeah, it's kind of the best of times, worst of times for writers, because the opportunities for traditional publishing are, statistics, but they're pretty small. It's pretty unlikely that someone's going to get a big book deal if you just look at numbers. So that's kind of the worst of times, though people are reading like crazy. People are not reading any less than they ever were before. And writers have more avenues for getting their work in print or online or whatever it is that they want to do, establishing readers, and than they've ever had before. And you found that when you used CreateSpace to do your columns. Pam learned that with Orange Hat, that, kind of that hybrid hybrid model. So, and, you don't have to have a physical book. You can have a website that people follow, or a blog, or someone was just talking about an app that serializes novels. So people that subscribe to the app then get a chapter a month or whatever, and there's all kinds of so there's a lot of varieties of ways that people can get their writing across. And I like what Pam started with, which is, what is your ultimate goal? Is it to be a famous best-selling author? Well, then you should quit your day job, and you should do a lot of learning and a lot of writing. And or is your or is your goal to reach readers and to reach other hearts? And is 10 enough? And is 20 enough? And is 40 great? And 100 really super? And so I think thinking about that is really important. And if it's writing your work and connecting with other people, there are ways to do it.
Yes.
For everyone.
Mm-hmm. And what you two just said is just such a great message for our listeners because, again, the who you're writing for. And I knew that a book of columns is not going to sell very well, and it hasn't. But I'm so happy I did it because I have it for, you know, I was saying to our two guests when we had a break that, you know, I had all these columns I've written, and I think some of them are really good. And I didn't want them just to leave them in the folder, and when I die, you know, they'd go out with everything else. So I'm glad I did the book. It's for children and grandchildren and anybody who's interested in it. Mm-hmm. So, Andy Rooney, by the way, maybe I think we have time for a quick response to this, but kind of writer's block I've got a question about. But somebody asked Andy Rooney one time, do you know this quote? They said to him, how long does it take to write a column? And he gave just the best answer. He said, the good ones write themselves and the bad ones take weeks. It's just as somebody who writes columns, the ones I struggle over are never as good as the ones that I sit down and they still need revision. But sometimes it just flows out, you know. So do you think there's a writer's block, or do you think that's
I think it's a perfection block. I don't think it's a writer's block. I think you can sit down and write words anytime you want. But when you don't write them, it's because you're trying to make them too good right off your pen. That's my pontificating on that.
Great.
And I agree. I mean, I don't even like the term because it can just stop people in their tracks.
It's
and
a great
it's
excuse.
It's another excuse.
Another
right.
excuse writers can use. A writer, who I didn't know till I saw this quote, but Abigail Thomas once said the following, I didn't start writing until I was 47. I had always wanted to write, but I thought you needed a degree or membership in a club nobody's asked me to join. Mm-hmm. It was a long time before I realized that you don't have to start right. You just have to start. I would like to thank my guests today, writers Kim Scher and Pam Parker, for sharing your passion for writing and your thoughts for those who are embarking on this journey, for your great work, your great writing, and for being here today. I really thank you.
Thank
you.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
And finally, thanks to you, our listeners, for sharing with us your time this Saturday morning. I'm Linda Fleshensky, and I hope that you will join us here at WGTD every Saturday morning for this program as we explore the important subjects that touch our communities, because as we all know so well, community matters. Take care.
You've been listening to Community Matters. All programs are archived at WGTD.org. Click shows. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.
Support for WGTD comes from Piasecki Althouse. Since 1931, Piasecki Althouse has provided unmatched, compassionate service and are dedicated to your family, guests, and supporting the community. Piasecki Althouse Funeral Home, honoring personal legacies and the circle of life. 262-658-4101.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, that's what keeps you coming back. Visit jackandrea.com for more information. Support for WGTD comes from Lemon Street Gallery. The Art Blast is coming to Lemon Street for young adults 13+. Fun and exciting sessions featuring pottery, painting, and assemblage. Mondays through Fridays, July 30th through August 2nd from 1 to 5 p.m. Call 605-4745 for more. From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, Jam On Fighting Human Trafficking Through the Arts is an all-day event held at Memorial Hall in downtown Racine on Saturday, August 4th. This dance workshop and concert is to benefit the cause. Visit fighttoendexploitation.org for more.
Support comes from the Racine Theater Guild, presenting Sister Act, the feel-good smash based on the hit film. The extended run now includes a fourth weekend with an extra show Friday, June 1st, and two performances Saturday, June 2nd. For show times and ticket information, visit racinetheater.org.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the ADRC hosts a free six-week educational series entitled Powerful Tools for Caregivers. To teach tools for self-care, program begins May 31st at the Kenosha County Center. Register online at ADRC.kenoshacounty.org.
I'm Gregory Berg,
And on Monday's morning show for Memorial Day, I'll be replaying my conversation with Patrick O'Donnell, the author of The Unknowns, which tells the story of the original unknown soldier of World War I and the decorated soldiers who brought his body home to Arlington National Cemetery. Support comes from Carthage College, combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation. More information is available at carthage.edu.
Support for WGTD comes from Lemon Street Gallery, the introduction to the Potter's